Life Out Loud is a literary nonfiction podcast series that features real student stories. Born in a John Jay College creative nonfiction writing classroom in the fall 2015 semester, Life Out Loud seeks to diversify the perspectives typically shared in the CNF genre. Our project aims to amplify voices seldom heard through artful truth-telling simply because we believe that all stories matter. We make them, and they make us. You can always listen at lifeoutloudpodcast.com.
Hi there, and welcome back to Life Out Loud, a literary nonfiction podcast where we tell true, maybe all too stories. I'm Max, one of your hosts tonight.
I'm Karen. Hi, everyone, and welcome back.
And I'm Kim. Glad to be back. Yet another episode.
Hi, everyone. I'm Christina. If you're joining our virtual roundtable tonight, this is the fifth episode of our eighth season entitled Dimensions of a Dad.
And I'm Ashley. In this episode, two authors explore the varied and sometimes contradicting sides of one of the most important men in their lives.
And I'm Lindsay. Now let's get into the first story of the night.
This story is by a now second-time author on the podcast who you usually hear as a host, Christina.
Christina Green is a junior at John Jay. She's a forensic psychology major and a writing and rhetoric minor. She fell in love with the creative nonfiction genre because she has always loved to connect with people by sharing stories. She thinks her life is one long TV show in which the episodes seem to write themselves.
Let's take a listen to Christina's piece entitled On Patrol.
I am 5. No, not years old. It's my number. Dad started this thing where he refuses to be called by name. He only responds to 44. He asked everyone to pick a number. I picked 5. Erin chose 7. Even our dog, Buddy, has a number. He has no choice. His number is 9 because, as 44 puts it,
duh, he is a canine.
Mom refuses to feed into it. So she doesn't have a number yet. Even though Mom doesn't like it, it's catching on. My friends all ask for numbers. Tracy called dibs on 21. Miguel chose 23. Even our manager asked Erin and I to assign her a number. So we chose 12. People laugh when I tell them about this new rule, but 44 takes it pretty seriously. He goes on patrol with Buddy most nights. They drive around town in the middle of the night hunting for crime. He keeps a notepad full of cryptic, indecipherable notes. He calls 911 at least once a day to report a crime or emergency he witnessed. He even texts in cop lingo.
5, it's 44. What's your 1020? Copy, receive. 44 on a stop.
It sounds funny on paper. It's even funnier when I tell people about it out loud. But that's because I try my best to make it sound like a joke. I think everyone is under the impression that 44 is just really committed to the bit. But the truth is, he really thinks we need to talk in code, conceal our identities, and go off the grid. He thinks he's being followed. Many people suffer from seasonal depression in the wintertime, but 44 and many other bipolar people get manic when the summer swaps places with the spring. I always have to remind myself that none of this is normal. I don't think other people freak out at their kid for accidentally answering the phone, "Hey, Dad."
It's not Dad. I'm 44. It's 44.
Or scream at you to shut your location off because they think the car behind you has taken one too many of the same turns as him. Or give their kids 10 minutes to pack a bag before dragging them to some hotel where they will unknowingly live for half the summer, claiming the phones are tapped and not allowing them to tell their friends where they are. I wish I could be as nonchalant as Mom. I feel like she should do something to protect us. All she says is,
"Oh well,"
or shrugs and says,
"Let him,"
and tells me to leave her alone. I try to make her understand how frustrated I feel. She has to know something is wrong. There's no way she thinks this is okay. Normal people don't have 2 personal phones. They don't make their kid memorize which phone to call for whatever reason. 375 is connected to the car's Bluetooth, so that's the line we use to ask for a ride. 355 is for wellness check-ins. And intel must be saved for in-person. intel is any report of suspicious activity, like the sketchy van parked outside of Tracy's house that scares us out of walking home at night. If you make the mistake of bringing up intel on the phone, 44 immediately cuts you off.
Don't say another word. I'll meet you at the rendezvous in 2 minutes, 5.
I don't like to be in the car with him when he's like this. He's suspicious of everyone, especially on the road. Cars with tints, cars that speed, cars that crackle as they weave between other cars. Yet, from where I'm sitting, he is the most suspicious driver of all. Sometimes he even retaliates against those types of drivers who are actually just clueless strangers. He swerves the car, brake checks them, curses under his breath. He reaches over to turn on the dash cam. He calls a non-emergency line because they said he had to stop calling 911. He starts screaming out numbers and letters and states for you to jot down on that legal pad where he documents evidence of his mania or suspicious activity in our suburban neighborhood. The most common crime here is auto theft, which shouldn't be a problem because he almost never leaves the car. Yet somehow, Mom swears he's not sick, that this isn't mania. When we tell other people about our codename system, they laugh. The person we're sharing the story with always turns to Mom at some point and asks her, "Wait, so what's your number?" And she always says something like,
"That shit is stupid. I don't have a number."
I know this is temporary. The mania will eventually melt away. I try to remember the place between the mania and the depression. No paranoia or anhedonia, just Dad. The man who has held on to every certificate I've brought home from school, who urges me to put them into a scrapbook to match the one he made for himself to preserve his achievements in football. The man who wished Seven didn't stop recording after he fell off a skateboard in the middle of Kmart, so she could have captured a few more seconds of her favorite memory together. Who teaches me all the big words I know, like recalcitrant, remuneration, voracious, and loquacious. Who is always the first to show up to the midnight snack and talks in movie quotes. The man who taught me that hope stands for hold on, possibilities exist. Who helps others no matter how inconvenient the circumstances. Watch him give motivational speeches to schools and churches for free. Give away our only umbrella to an elderly woman walking past the pizza shop window. Pull over into the gore point of the highway to talk a friend down from the edge on the way to our vacation. Drive 2 hours away to check another into rehab. It's so easy to forget that he never stays in one state forever. He's either in bed speechless, in the car screaming, or out and about making jokes. How could one person be so many different people? Even though I only get in the car with 44 for 16 minutes a day, 8 minutes to and from the mall where I serve ice cream, I can't wait around for him to get better. It's time to stop depending on him. I need to face my greatest fear, which is, unfortunately, driving. But if it means a break from 44 and all those stressful car rides, I have to do it. I need to dust off my license and start the search. I have the means and the motivation. I just need one more thing. A car. 44 drives Erin and I to work while I save up. I know I need to get serious about looking for a car because spring sprung up on me and I can't spend another summer in the backseat of 44's car hoping no one will trigger him until after I get out. After 5 months, I do it. Buy my own used Ford Fusion. No more crazy car rides where I hold my breath every time a car with tint flies by in the left lane. No more flinching at the beep of the dash cam. I have my own car now. Would I miss the rides with 44? Turns out, I wouldn't have a chance to find out. Today, my neighbor's 16-year-old unlicensed friend Guy took his Miata for a spin. Guy whipped his car around the corner on Hoboken Road, lost control of the steering wheel just as he made his way onto 8th Street, both sides of the already narrow street lined with cars. Good news is that Guy was able to avoid hitting all but one of the 12 cars on the block this afternoon. The bad news is that the one car he hit was mine. I was already starting to forget which number was for what. Now, I'm stuck dialing 375 every day. Hey, 44, can you give me a ride to work? Now that the weather's starting to calm down, so is 44. And now I'm finally starting to find the 44-bit funny. He just learned how to send voice notes over text, so he uses it to pretend he's on a walkie-talkie. And 44 has perfected his radio voice. And you wouldn't believe how good he is at mimicking the static noise. His impression of a police siren makes me laugh every time. I even have a 5-gibbet on my croc. 44, 7, and I still use our numbers to refer to each other most of the time. Mom still refuses to engage. Well, up until Christmas. As we make cookies at a friend's house, we all explain our numbers, and then my Aunt Gina gets to that point in the story where she starts to wonder the same thing as everyone else. What's Mom's number? We all wait for Mom to say her usual,
"That shit is stupid,"
or just roll her eyes, but today, she doesn't. Instead, she holds up a finger.
"I'm one,"
she says before a pause.
"Because I'm number one."
Received 44 on a stop, New Jersey plate, needed to run it back, Alpha Bravo Charlie, 12627. Come back, receive.
Wow.
Wow.
Just, we're on a roll this semester.
Yeah, truly. Yeah, thank you so much, Christina, for a second brilliant story you're sharing with us and the listeners. As you are well aware, this is the time where we have to ask you a couple questions, if that's all right with you.
All right, let's hear them.
All right, well, I'll go first. What was the overall writing process like? Like, what made you choose the story to tell? I can't imagine it was easy to write, but from the tone and care you took in structuring the story this way, many scenes from it feel like core memories.
Okay. So I knew that this was a story that I had to write because I kind of just tell it to everybody. Like when it was happening, I would tell my friends about it. And like they would laugh about it. And I was like, okay, like whatever, it's a joke. And then as things calmed down and like my dad got better, it continued to be funny. Like I would be like, oh yeah, 44 is picking me up today, and everybody would still like know him as 44. But I knew that it was gonna be something that I wanted to write because I enrolled for the creative nonfiction class. I gotta tell people about this because everyone in my life knows about it and everybody thinks it's funny, so I thought I'd share.
You went into class knowing you're gonna write this at some point.
Yes, I knew. I was like, all right, when the right prompt comes up, I'm going to tell this story.
And how has writing the story changed or shaped you?
I think it made me feel a lot more confident about writing stories. Sometimes, like, I know I'm always telling people I think I live in a movie, and I really do, but sometimes I'm, like, questioning. Like, is this really, like, unusual enough and, like, interesting enough for people, for an audience to read?
This is definitely that.
Oh, yeah. 100%. Without a doubt.
So, I was just wondering how it would be received. Not, like, in, like, a shameful way. I didn't really have, like, a hard time emotionally writing it because it feels normal to me. So, I guess...
Right.
When I was writing it, I was like, I guess this is kind of, nobody does this. Like only my family like would do something like this.
It's, I think, my dad. That was one of the prompts, right? It was like, what's something that goes on in your house or in your family that's like normal to you, but might not necessarily be normal to someone else or something?
Yeah, I read that and I was like, it kind of fits. Cause I think it was what was in your childhood home. And I was like, okay, this is my chance to write it. Okay, I'm going to do it.
I mean, I definitely agree that it's like your life is like a movie. I mean, after her story, I was like, she wrote another one. Like, we're doing her again. Like, there's no way. It really was interesting and it was good.
Sick of me. Yeah. I know, you just keep giving us quality entertainment. We're living for it, girl.
I'm like, what's the next episode?
Yeah.
We're doing it right now. Weekly basis, like, you know, weekly air dates.
Recurring
every
guys.
Friday.
And speaking of referring to your father as 44, throughout the story, you interchange referring to your father as 44 and dad. At one point, you say, I try to remember the place between the mania and the depression. No paranoia, no anhedonia, just dead. And at another, you say, but if it means a break from 44 and all those stressful car rides, I have to do it. There are minimal times where you refer him to his dad. Why'd you choose to call him 44? At times and dad. And I'm curious, when you talk about him to other people, what do you call him?
It depends. It depends. Most people know him as 44, or my friends will even call him 44. Or they'll correct me if I say dad. They're like, oh, you mean 44? In the story specifically, I mostly refer to him as 44 because it was the time where I was only allowed to call him 44. I knew it would make him upset if I called him dad. So it was like, I had to tread very carefully, especially when I picked up the phone. So when I refer to him as dad, it's kind of like those moments where he's not manic, or just like the flashbacks kind of differentiate between the two sides of him. But for the most part, everybody knows about him as 44. Yeah.
You talk about him being like better now, quote unquote, or like what did anything like change in like his life, or is he like, did he get like a formal diagnosis or medication or anything like that?
Okay.
If you're comfortable talking about it.
Oh, like, no, totally.
Because it feels like this is like very much like, and in the past, like when he was like this thing. So what is he like now?
So he's, we call it like baseline. He's not depressed. He's not manic. He's just kind of somewhere in the middle. And it's kind of just like the time of year and maybe his like new psychiatrist. probably mixing the two, but like in the wintertime, he like usually goes through a depressive episode, and then in the summer, like in that one, that's just one example of one of his manic episodes. It is really seasonal. It does affect his mood and his disorder.
Hi, Christina. So there's a scene at the end with your mother that is incredibly touching. It's the moment where she finally gives a response to what her designated number is. You say, she holds up a finger. One, she says before a pause, because I'm number one. The inclusion of that feels very, very heartwarming and so telling to her and your father's relationship. Throughout the story, you express understandable frustration with your mom's nonchalance, and the inclusion of the last scene feels like you are coming to terms with how much you exactly have to experience to get to that point. Have you ever spoken to your mother about your father's mental health and what they've been through together navigating it?
I've talked to her about it before, definitely, but I've always felt like she didn't accept it. She still won't refer to it as mania. She'll just be like, you're out of control. She said that to me today. Like, oh, no, he wasn't sick. He was just out of control. So I definitely have been frustrated with her a lot in the past because it's so clear to me when he's like that. But I am a psych major, so maybe it's just like my knowledge of the disorder. Even my dad, he has a degree in psychology, and my sister too. So it to him, it's not clear. He's like, I'm not manic. What are you talking about? Like, he jokes about it now, but I guess she didn't have the insight, so she just sees it as like, oh, he's just like in one of his like moods. But he is diagnosed. It is like something he's aware of. But
right, so an official diagnosis, but still,
yeah, but still, like he. You can't say it to him in the moment. It'll make him even like more angry.
I see.
It's like I'm not manic. What are you talking about? It's like it. It's better to avoid it at the time. When she sees him like that, she just kind of she'll have any sort of like other explanation for what it is.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
And before we wrap up, this is just a personal question I had just as we were talking. But I know a lot of people use writing to kind of cope with what they've gone through in life or what they're going through in life. At least that's how I use it. So I was just curious, do you keep these pieces for yourself to kind of handle things that you've been through, or do you share it like with your family members? Like, has your dad maybe read this piece, or is that just a keep it on the DL kind of thing?
I actually let him read it this morning. You'd have to like meet my dad to know his, like, he's he jokes a lot. Like, he's like, once he sorry, I'm laughing because I'm thinking about it. He's like denigrating me once again, like, but he has like a sarcastic attitude about it.
You know, but I think it's that's like, a good thing that he can joke about it, and
yeah,
I'm sure he appreciates, like,
yeah, anytime I'm writing and I cry while I'm writing it, I'm like, all right, now I'm a real writer, like, this is a real piece. Like, yeah, exactly. I'm like, there's emotion in this, like, this is a quality piece of writing right here. That's kind of how I judge my pieces, like, oh, I didn't cry, I keep working on it.
There's what's the beginning essay, there's a craft essay called The Creative Nonfiction Police, and it's about the ethics of writing about the truth as art. And I used to assign it in class, Christina, and I recently took it off because of the way the weeks fell with our hybrid course. It was like one too many readings, and but anyway, okay. I'm missing it all the time. I'm gonna put it back, but anyway. At the end of it, it goes through all the sort of ethics of this art form. And then at the end, it gives like a little list of like ways to check yourself and your ethics. And one of the things is, I forget the way he words it, but it's something like, let, you know, anyone who's featured in your piece should read it. You should feel comfortable. It doesn't mean that they're going to agree with the way you paint them, but it shouldn't be kept from them. That if you write something about someone in this genre, that you should be willing to stand behind it and allow them to read it. And if you're not, then there's some ethics problem. Perhaps it's just that it's not the right time to share the content to share, or perhaps you know you're fudging the truth a little bit or whatever. But it says that, you know, if you're not willing to share with the subject of a piece, there might be some sort of ethical problem behind the piece. So I'm very happy that you shared it with him this morning.
Yeah, he was like, oh, it's nice. Well, paints me in a bad light. I was like, no. My mom too. She I was like, you have the big ending. Like, you have a line.
What did she say?
She's crying, and she apologized to me. I think she read the part where I was frustrated with her, and she apologized to me for not listening at the time, and like, so it was really full circle.
Wow,
that's the beautiful thing about writing.
That's great. Mm-hmm. That's really great. It's different than like sitting someone down and telling them about things that, you know, versus like someone reads it in a piece and they're a little more removed and they can understand how you felt. It's different than like, it's different than like explicitly calling someone out about something.
Yeah. Wow. Well, this was certainly a beautiful piece. And for our last question, we just want to know what you would like listeners to take away from this story.
I was dreading this question. I don't know if I have anything that I need readers to take away from the story, except for the people who don't believe me that my life is moving.
this is exhibit A.
Exhibit A. Exactly.
Okay, maybe I can revamp the question a little bit. What is something maybe you took away from writing the story? Sorry, I caught you off guard with that.
No, I mean, I realized this reflect.
While you think about it, Christina, just to give you a minute to think, I just want to say that one of the things I think is so genius about this piece is the way Christina strikes the balance between comedy and tragedy.
Yeah,
like we're laughing and everything is so funny, and then like we're up here, which gives us all the further to fall. So it's like an old trick to like make the audience laugh. I don't know if I'm not saying Christina did this on purpose, but it's an old theater trick or something, or movie trick or something. You make the audience laugh, and then when something is sad right after, it hurts even more because you were just so up, you have further to fall. And this really strikes that balance in a way that was really poignant for me.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I also think you have such a... Oh, I'm so sorry, Karen. You go.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think you have such a beautiful talent for turning what people might think into such, like, tragic events into a beautiful story where readers feel like they're actually there with you, but it's not a burden or anything. Like, they want to be there. They want to keep reading.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, like, you're not asking us to feel sorry for you or for him.
Yeah, it's so easy.
Yeah, like, there might be a level of sympathy or empathy, but it doesn't feel like that. It just feels like we're just, like, watching the way this is.
And unfold.
Watching the TV episodes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Tune in.
Like, it's just, like, life. Mm-hmm. It was just such a depiction of your life. Like, yeah. And like, the ending on this, like, joke of, like, your mom being like, because I'm number one. And I was like, after that, I was like, period. But I also kind of wanted to cry because I was like, that just feels so, like loaded and heartful, like, yeah. Like, it wasn't in the question. It's just like, yeah, it all kind of is like, all right, I'm giving into this, to this thing that he does that, you know, right, yeah. Obviously so, like, mm-hmm. against even partaking in. She's like, you know what, I am number one.
Their love for each other. Despite the...
It was such a shock.
It just got me.
Sorry, do you guys refer to her as number one, or is that just, like, just a...
Oh, no. I'm like, girl, that's not your number. You're not part of this. What are you talking about? When she dropped that on us, I was like... What? Like, all of us, like, what?
Did you just say that?
Yeah, because it was months and months, the whole summer, she wasn't feeding into it, like, the winter, like, she did not say a word, and then just one random day, she was like, oh, I'm number one. We were like, since when? Like,
it's so funny because it's like, you're playing into it more than even, it's like, you're mm-hmm. taking it very seriously now. You're like, no, mm-hmm. that's not your number.
Girl, it's too late. If you
were established, you had to be there day one.
Yeah, like, the dog had a number and everything, and she was just like, I don't have the number, like, stop asking me, like, I don't participate. Like, so we were all just kind of sitting there like, girl, what possessed you? Like, when did you come up with this? Like, she was waiting for that moment when someone was gonna ask her, because almost everybody knew at that point. So when they found out, we all found out together that was her number. Like, she tried to be part of it.
She got on board. She hopped on the trend, and she went with full confidence.
Exactly. Like, girl, what are you doing? I don't know. I don't think I've recovered from that moment either. I still think about it. I'm like, when did she come up with that? Like, she's, I don't know.
So I guess if your mom didn't have a number, what did 44 refer to her as?
Honestly, that's a good question. In the moment, she was just kind of always there, so he would just be like, she or her, like. I guess he would give in and say mom at some point, but he, like, I don't know. I guess she just kind of had a pass because she's just mom. Like, she, like, runs the house.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
She got a pass.
But I guess to answer the question, mm-hmm. what I took away from this story was... Sorry, I'm ADHD. I already forgot what the question. What I took away from the story was that I really do like to connect with people out loud, like, when I tell a story. So I'm always, like, worried when I try to write it down, I get frustrated because I can't type as fast as I can think. And, like, I took away my new writing process, which is to just voice note it, and then I just, like, copy back how I'm, like, voice noting it.
Wow,
that's really smart, actually. Wait a minute,
because that's how I tell. Because I usually tell the story a couple of times, and then I kind of have an idea of how I tell a story, so it's the right delivery and everything. So now I was sitting down, and I was like, how am I going to tell the story? Because I've told this a million times, so I just was like, okay, how would I talk to somebody? How would I introduce them to this, like, ridiculous story that I've told 100 times already?
Wow, that's a really good technique. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm going to be busy after this.
Yeah, right? Like, I have some things to try now. Wait a minute.
This is really exactly smart. Like,
especially if it's a story that you tell all the time. Then
yeah. But you have it down.
Right.
The degree. So that's how I try to make it sound like I'm telling you the story, not just like you're reading it.
But you did do a lot of revisions too. You did a lot of work on this. Yeah. Great job.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Yeah, thank you
thank
so much for
you Christina.
sharing, Christina.
I'm so glad to be here again. Everybody, great chatting. This story is by a new author to the podcast, Brianna.
Brianna Gardere is a recent Law and Society BA graduate at John Jay. She has been writing since the age of 14. She wrote fiction for years and then picked up a love for creative nonfiction through the intro course she took the first semester of her junior year. Brianna always had a deep appreciation for her life, but never saw it as anything worth reading about until meeting several professors who showed her the endless potential in the material. Absence was her first truly personal piece. It was healing for her, and her hope is that she can touch those who have been through similar life experiences.
Let's take a listen to Brianna's piece entitled Absence.
Brianna, como mamu abdi mo papa le na graduation? Well, hello to you too, Dad. An exasperated sigh escapes my parted lips, but it's faint, far too quiet to express my exhaustion. It's not like I didn't expect my mother not to tell him that I don't want to attend my high school graduation, and it's not like I didn't expect him to call me about it either. It's just the speed at which everything happened. It's been like, what, 20 minutes since I dropped the news? And it's only been 5 since she called to tell him about it. I just don't want to, Dad. He hates it when I do that, when I speak in English while he's speaking to me in Creole. But hey, he understands just fine. Besides, any way that I can get under his skin for trying to live in mine is a win for me. Si c'est l'argent, moi qu'a voyé plus l'argent pour, he tells me. I bite back another sigh, because while I got away with one, a second one would be pushing it. Of course he thinks it's about the money. I could tell him the truth. I could tell him that the social anxiety he doesn't know that I have has gotten so bad over the course of the last 3 years that just the thought of walking in front of all those people makes me sick. I could tell him that, but it wouldn't matter. So instead, I plaster on my biggest smile in the hopes that it will influence my tone of voice, and I say, yes, Dad, I just wanted to use the graduation money for something else. Eh bien, ma voye plus copu, he promises. And maybe the thought of more money should have me feeling a little excited, but the dread of attending my graduation outweighs it. Merci, papa. Nepot bagay puti fimwe, he says, voice much softer than it was just moments ago. He always says that. Anything for my little girl. He says it so much and shows it even more. I'm his little girl, and he'd truly do anything for me. So what if I have to walk across the stage before a bunch of teenagers that terrify me? Screw the teenagers. They won't matter when I meet my father's warm gaze from across the room. And so, I agree to go to my graduation. The tale of the absent father has always been a prominent one in my community. Growing up, asking another black kid if their dad has come back from the store yet was almost as much of an ooh-worthy moment as your mom jokes. I would laugh, but I never partake in those jokes. It would feel cruel to offer commentary on something I hadn't experienced. Because my father, well, he doesn't fall under the absent black father trope, which is funny considering how far he lives. I mean, I'm here in New York and he's all the way in Haiti. The topic of him moving here permanently has been tossed around the dinner table a couple of times during his visits, but my father is a stubborn man. He's hell-bent on staying in that country. He's gone on far too many rants about how his career as an engineer has already been established, and how he spent too long creating the blueprint and overseeing the construction of his massive home to leave it, and how he's worked too hard and gained too much respect to throw it all away and start over. Personally, I believe he's just a man of habit, but he would never settle for an explanation so simple. It wouldn't get his point across. So he remains over there, all the way over there. He's all the way in Haiti, and yet he's here. 1,505 miles away, and yet he's always here. Those 1,505 miles don't mean a thing when it comes to my father. They don't stop a thing. They don't stop him from lecturing me about grades on a report card he can't even see, or telling me that he knows I'll do better next time moments later. They don't stop him from antagonizing me over things I choose to buy while continuing to send me money each month to use as I please. They don't stop that dejected tone in his voice when he pleads with me on the phone to be kinder to my mom, or the relieved sigh when I promise I will be. They don't stop the twice-a-year visits to the States where he glues himself to me, or the father-daughter trips he takes me on when he's here. God, the father-daughter trips are arguably one of my favorite times of year. I adore every trip we've ever taken together, even the most recent one to Montreal where I caught food poisoning hours before we had to leave and spent the entire 10-hour bus ride back to New York breaking out in a cold sweat while fighting the urge to vomit. My father held my hand and spoke reassuring words to me the entire way through, attempting to keep his calm, though it was clear he was damn near ready to get the driver to reroute us to the nearest hospital. Even when he's 1,505 miles away, I can sense that same urgency to protect me at all costs. 1,505 miles away, and yet on most days, it feels like I can feel the heat of his gaze boring into the nape of my neck every moment of every day. 1,505 miles away, and yet sometimes it feels like he's more present than my mother, whose roof I live under. 1,505 miles, yeah, they don't stop a thing. And my father, well, he's a God-fearing man, but I fear God himself couldn't stop him either. And my father, well, he sometimes forgets he's my father and not my guardian angel. And my father, I love him dearly, and I know he loves me the same. More, even. But I wonder if he knows how suffocating his love can be. I wonder if it would change anything if I were to tell him. I wonder if it would break his heart to know how much I ache for space. And I don't mean to sound ungrateful. I know that I have it better than most. My father is 1,505 miles away, and yet he's more present than most parents. My father, he's so present that sometimes I wish he was absent. Not permanently, just a little vacation, a day, a week or so, a month maximum, just so I can be a teenager. Just a day, a week or so, a month maximum. I just want to kiss a boy without the fear of him finding out. I want to kiss a boy without having him call me to yell at me for being a disgrace. I want to kiss a boy without knowing I'll go to sleep crying that night. Just a week or so, a month maximum. I just want to have fun with friends without hearing that going out will hold me back from my goals in life. I just want to have fun with my friends while he's visiting without his unwavering gaze telling me how disappointed he is in me. Just a week, a month maximum. I just want to wear tight jeans and makeup without being antagonized for it, without being told over the phone that I'm growing up too fast, after feeling confident enough to post a picture on Facebook after months of my profile collecting cobwebs. A month maximum. I just don't want to have to tiptoe around life worried about disappointing him. If he were to be absent, just for a day, a week or so, a month maximum, I could breathe a little easier, right? This thought follows me into my sleep some nights. I think it may have been what I was dreaming about before slowly being roused from my rest tonight. My eyes feel heavy, matted down by crust built during what felt like 5 minutes of sleep. My mouth tastes like ass despite me brushing my teeth and my tongue before bed. The garlic and Domino's pizza never fails to have that effect. There is a voice speaking softly, a gentle tapping on my shoulder that becomes more insistent the longer I try to ignore it. I give in to the voice and to the tapping, and my eyes flutter open. My mother comes into focus, and there are tears in her eyes. The first thing I think is, who died? Because someone must have died, right? What follows is, was it my father? Did he die? But no, that's ridiculous. Of course my father didn't die. He couldn't have, because these things do not happen to me. I have never experienced the death of a loved one, and I have never had to drape myself in black to say goodbye because these things never happen to me. except they do, because my father is dead. At least that's what my mother tells me. And for a moment, I wonder if it's some sick joke. But no, it couldn't be, because my mother is not a cruel person. She's honest and she is kind. I have known that my entire life, and yet for once, I wish that wasn't the truth. I'd forgive her for this if it was a lie. Anything for it to be untrue. But it isn't a lie. The never-ending stream running down her face says as much. My brother crying out and melting to the floor says as much. My sister clutching her chest as she tries to catch her breath says as much. My utter silence says as much. Well, my father is absent now. He's not on a week-long vacation, and he's not on a month-long one either. He's absent, and it's permanent. He's absent, as in dead. He died in his car on his way back to his home. The roads in the homeland can be tough sometimes, and apparently, the stress was too much for his heart. He died in his car on his way back from Okap because he knew how much my siblings and I loved the peanut brittle from that one specific place. He died in his car on his way back home, merely 3 days away from leaving Haiti to visit the States. He died in his car on his way back home, trying to make it to the stupid fucking graduation I didn't even want to go to begin with. Well, he's absent, as in dead. And I no longer need to go to my graduation. He's absent, as in dead. So I'm finally able to kiss boys without the fear of him finding out. And I can finally hang out with friends without hearing that it's holding me back from my goals in life. And I can finally wear tight jeans without being antagonized about growing up too fast. Hell, I've even been throwing drinking into the mix just because I can. Because my father, he's absent now. He's absent, and I'm free to do as I please, so why can't I breathe any easier? Why is it that I can't stop having panic attacks or waking up freezing from my own sweat every night, feeling as if the air is being punched out of me? Because he's my father, and he's absent now, and breathing has never been harder. My father is absent, which means he may become my guardian angel. I'd seek comfort in that, but him watching over me would mean seeing who I've become. No one seems very happy with who I've become. You're getting out of hand, my mother has told me too many times. And maybe she's right, but she doesn't understand. Her wretched father is still alive, so how could she? No one does, really. My siblings lost their fathers too, but sometimes it feels like even they don't understand. I spent the most time with him whenever he visited, so how could they? I avoid speaking to my therapist about it, even though that is the reason I decided to seek therapy after years of considering it. I talk about other things, how the girls in college still act like they're in high school, which worsens my social anxiety, how annoying my mom has become, the crush I'm developing on one of my coworkers, anything, everything but what I actually came here for. I talk about everything but the reason why I showed up in the first place, so my therapist doesn't understand either. How could she? No one understands, and sometimes neither do I. It takes too long to discover that grief comes in waves, and maybe that is why I have such a hard time understanding that, or the fact that I avoid thinking about it as much as I can. It's not like it helps, anyway. I still notice. That vacancy in my mind keeps begging to be filled, so I fill it with liquor. The air that follows me keeps me cold, so I warm myself with the heat of others. And the only relief from that foggy feeling is spitting on someone so I can get socked in the face. It lasts but a blissful moment, and then nothing. That's the worst of it. The dissociation. My therapist says it's a defense mechanism, but defense mechanisms are meant to protect you. So why am I scared all the time? I often wonder if it'll go away. I often wonder if this is it for me now. I often wonder if this is it for me now. It could become my new normal. I could learn to become comfortable with it. Hell, I could even learn to love it. It would be for the best now that I've realized that there is no moving on from this loss. Because my father's presence, it kept me grounded. It kept me from floating too high, straying too far. It kept me sane and intact. His presence could be suffocating at times,
but the lack of it may truly be the end of me. It's a scary thought because I don't imagine I'll end up in the paradise I've envisioned he's in. I don't imagine I'd end up somewhere far worse either. Perhaps I'd be somewhere in the middle, floating, straying, sort of like how I am now, because my father, he's absent now, and on most days, it feels like I am too.
Wow, that was so touching at the end there. Oh, it just wraps it up really nicely.
Rihanna.
Seriously, thank you so much for sharing your story. We're gonna get into just some questions that we have for you regarding it. I noticed that when you're writing the story, you don't give direct translations for the words your dad's saying, Rio, and instead use descriptions and other sentences to frame these bits. What was the thinking behind that choice, and how do you think it contributes to the readers and listeners' understanding of the story?
I'm going to be completely honest. This is something that I learned from a professor, Professor Madrazo. She stated that, you know, when you directly translate, it doesn't flow as well, which I noticed in my past writing because I was the kind of person who would directly translate. And I realized that there are so many ways to portray what's being said without actually telling people. And also, like, context clues, they make writing more interesting. So I figured that was a really good way to add those in.
Right. Yeah, we still understand it, even if we don't speak it, because of the context.
Before I jump into my question, I just wanted to let you know that this story, tears were pouring down my face. I was reading it out loud to myself, and I couldn't even get the words out. I've never been emotionally impacted by something like that before. Like, maybe never a story, like movies, like maybe I'll cry, but like, this is the best story I've ever encountered. Like, it's my favorite story I've worked on for the podcast. I loved it so much, and it really resonated with me in such an interesting way. And I really want to thank you for sharing it, because I understand how vulnerable it is to put yourself out there and to write a piece like this. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Seriously. Thank you.
And Christina's been working on the podcast for 3 semesters. So that's saying a lot. She's worked on a lot of stories.
Oh, I took a walk around. I just needed some air. I was like, wow, this is really beautiful.
Thank you.
But back to the interview. How do you think the inclusion of the repetition of the line 1,505 miles away contributes to demonstrating the duality of the relationship you had with your father, the good and the bad?
I feel like for me, when I was writing that, I genuinely feel like the distance, like showing how far we were, like physically, was a great way of showing that despite how far we are, you know, the relationship is still strong. But then as the story goes on, I started showing the portions of the relationship in which I wasn't very happy about the distance, you know, despite how far we were, like our relationship was still strong. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, like, you know, I think that the physical distance also represented the distance that I wasn't, like the emotional distance that I personally was not telling him about. So, yeah. Okay.
And do you think that if you had excluded the repetition, how do you think it might have taken away from the intensity of the situation?
I feel like people wouldn't really be able to. No, I think people would still be able to understand how deep and personal this connection was. But I genuinely feel like the repetition just kind of stamped it into everybody's head. Like, this is like the one of the prime relationships in my life. Like, this is it, you know? And it really just, like, especially me talking about how I felt essentially closer to him than I felt to my mom, who was there with me, you know? I feel like talking about how far apart we were was incredibly necessary to it. So, yeah.
Like, the story really did impact me, especially because me personally, I related to basically everything you were saying. You know, my father's love is also very suffocating. And love and suffocation can be so delicately intertwined with one another, but when pertaining to parents, it can be a source of guilt for children. How did you overcome this after his death, and what made you have changed about your thought process during that time period?
Honestly, I'm going to be completely honest, therapy. Talking to my therapist helped me understand that, you know, I was a teenager at the time, and genuinely, my father was a very overprotective man. And, you know, as you're growing, you just want to be able to explore and learn more about yourself. And I really wasn't being given the space to do that, you know, despite how far he was. He still, you know, had a very strong hold over my life. And essentially, it took me a while to understand that wanting that space, wanting that time, wanting that air was very valid. Obviously, directly after he died, I was just sort of like, what the hell? I was always asking, like, man, I really just wish I could catch a break for a second. And then he was gone, and all I really wanted was for him to be all up in my space again. But then, you know, as I kept on talking and talking and talking and talking about it, I just came to an understanding that it really is necessary growing up for you to have those boundaries with your parents. And if they don't exist, you are like, despite that was one of the most important things that I learned, that you can love somebody, but still in many ways resent them. And, you know, growing up, like, if you're not being given, if you're not having those clear set boundaries, it is easy. It is incredibly easy, actually, for that resentment to build and build and build. And I honestly just began to become more gentle with myself about it, because the way I felt was valid. Like, I understand that it was coming from a place of love, but it didn't really make it any easier at times. So, you know, it really just came down to, it's okay to feel that way. It's okay that you felt the way that you did. And it's okay to feel the way that you do now, like missing him and honestly sometimes wanting that back.
Honestly, I feel like everything you're saying is therapeutic to me, because I mean, not thinking about me, but like, that explains everything I feel now. Like, it makes sense.
Really good.
Powerful, really moving. Just the way you explain it and go about it.
Thank you.
So how do you think your story reflects relatable events that children of immigrants or foreign parents experience?
Honestly, I truly wouldn't be able to speak for everyone. I'd only be able to really speak for myself and like the people that I know, like personally, who have parents who do live very, very far away from them. I've come to understand that those relationships tend to be incredibly hard, and most of the time it is because of how far away that they are. I feel like from what I've seen, a lot of people did not really have, like, a lot of people that I know who have parents who don't live with them, like who live in a whole other place, they didn't have the same sort of the same exact, I don't want to say complexities, I don't know what word I'm looking for, the same exact
relationships, maybe.
The same exact what?
Nuances, like,
yeah, they didn't have the same nuances, you know. Like, it didn't seem like they felt, you know, suffocated in some senses. Like, it was more they were constantly missing their parents. They're constantly, you know, wishing that their parent was around. Where for me, a lot of times I was like, you know, yeah, I could miss my dad, but like, you know, he's gonna call me tomorrow anyways, or like, you know, obviously I want to be in his space, but I know like I'm gonna enjoy it and I'm gonna love it, but at the same time, like, I'm not always missing him, and I'm not always, but like, for the people that I know who also have parents really, really far away, they were constantly missing their parents. So I don't really, I can't really say that it's like,
right,
I don't know how to relate it back to like other people's experiences, because I really feel like this isn't 100%, or even really, but obviously nothing's ever going to be 100% a shared experience, but this isn't really like
representative of,
yeah, it isn't really representative.
It's no, like, it's not homogenous. There's so many different facets that go into this sort of relationships.
But this is really like a credit to your dad. You know, it seems to me like whether it was a conscious effort or not, like, he made it such that you didn't miss him. Like, he was so present, even though he was not there. And maybe it was like a specific conscious effort, or maybe it was just he missed you so much.
I truly believe that it was the latter. So yeah.
Yeah. So it's like you didn't even have a chance to miss him because he was just so present.
You already said so much like really beautiful and personally impactful things. And I just wanted to ask if there's anything you would like the listeners to sort of take away from the story, what do you think it would be?
I would say genuinely, just love, love, love as hard as you can. Like, right. I know that sounds so corny, but like,
No.
literally just love
No.
as hard as you can right now. Because when my dad, like, I did not even, that never even occurred to me that, like, obviously people in your life are gonna die, but it just didn't, especially the timing of it all. He was just about to come,
Yeah.
and then he just, people really just, they're gone. Like they're just gone at the most random times. And when he was here, there were a lot of times where I wasn't appreciative of all the moments that we had together. And obviously it's going to be very hard, especially in a relationship where you love somebody so deeply. In every single relationship, I feel like the more you love somebody, the more complicated things can get, the more intense, the more emotional things can get. So obviously there's going to be conflict. But there are so many moments where I look back and I'm like, damn, like I really could have just been in that moment. I could have just enjoyed it. Like maybe he was being a little bit too overprotective, but I could have, instead of telling him like you're being annoying, I could have told him like, okay, this is a bit much right now, but I understand why you're doing it. I could have been more understanding sometimes. He could have probably listened a bit better too, but like what I'm saying, all I'm saying is that, like, genuinely, I think that it's, I just look back on so many missed opportunities to love him, to show him how much I love him, to have hugged him when, like just so many stupid things that happened between us, like pointless arguments and pointless irritations and frustrations, when in those moments I could have been taking them to like cherish him, and especially knowing that everything that he did was always out of love. So for me, I like my dad dying just showed me that I genuinely need to love people. Like I have a very big heart, but I'm not always the best at showing it. So I feel like it's just important to constantly like never stay mad at somebody for too long, never hold grudges because that's just ridiculous. Like don't let things fester over like petty small things. Like that's my biggest, like, well, one of the biggest lessons that I learned, and that's genuinely something that I'd want other people to take away as well.
Oh, so beautiful. So
Excellent.
like eloquently
Thank
said, like I'm like awed right now. Thank you so much for talking and sharing all of this with us.
Thank you,
Thank you.
Brianna.
No problem. Thank you for interviewing me. I'm excited.
That concludes our fifth episode of the eighth season, Dimensions of a Dad. We are also excited to bring you these stories.
We are honored to continue amplifying voices from backgrounds you don't normally hear from in the creative nonfiction genre.
You can always find out more by checking out our beautifully crafted website, www.lifeoutloudpodcast.com, or by searching Life Out Loud Podcasts on iTunes, SoundCloud, or YouTube. We also have an Instagram and a Facebook if you want to get behind the scenes content.
We'd like to thank everyone who helps make this possible, including our sound engineers and editors.
As well as our episode writers, our website developers, everyone behind the scenes here at Life Out Loud.
And to our audience, we hope you love these stories as much as we did. It was a joy to bring them to you.
A very special thank you to everyone listening. We'll see you soon and good night.
Good
Good
night.
night.
Good
Night.
night.
Night.